Good morning. I'm going to start by asking a question. What do you think people in our culture, our community, think of when they hear the word religion? What do people think of?
Judgment.
What else?
Rules.
Hypocrisy. Say again? Disagreement. Division. Yeah. Something over here?
Mean people.
Yeah. Something. Hypocrisy. Somebody else said something?
Old-fashioned.
Old-fashioned. Yeah, for sure.
Close-minded.
Crusades. Ooh, that's a good one. What else? Couple more.
Ritual.
Superior, rigid structure. Irrelevant. So what are you guys doing here?
Coffee.
Coffee, thank you. All right. There are better places in Palo Alto for coffee, I gotta say. Well, I think it's true that religion in our culture doesn't have the best reputation. That's probably an understatement based on what we've collected here. A lot of people think it's outdated, irrelevant, it doesn't matter anymore, it's old-fashioned. I was at a neighborhood event in my neighborhood a few weeks ago, and I introduced myself, and this woman asked me what I did, and I said I was a pastor, and she said, "Really?" And I think she was thinking, people still do that? Like, is that still around? She's just incredulous. Now, so a lot of people think religion is unnecessary, it's irrelevant, but actually in our culture, there's people that go a step farther and think that religion is actually part of the problem, not part of the solution, that the world would be a better place if we just managed to wipe out religion entirely. And you can't always blame them for thinking that way. I mean, religious fundamentalists fighting each other and killing each other in countries around the world, religious people claiming in the name of religion to stand up with signs that are hateful and cruel, religious people getting embroiled in scandals and abuse situations and all sorts of stuff. So religion doesn't have a very good image in our culture. It's not very popular. So this morning, we're continuing our series as we're going through the Gospel of John, and we're calling it Signs of Life. Our suggestion has been that this gospel presents Jesus as the source of life to the world. And John's particular strategy has been to show these signs that were meant to induce faith so that by believing in these signs, believing in Jesus, people might have life. The problem that we're encountering this morning is that Jesus is a religious figure. We are a religious group this morning. At least that's how the world understands us and him. So how can we say that Jesus brings life to the world if the world thinks of religion in the ways that we just said that the world thinks of religion? How can we really make the claim? How can we make a convincing claim that Jesus is the source of life when it's so clear that few people think of religion as the source of life? Jesus starts off his ministry partly addressing this issue, partly challenging the nature of religion in his day. He begins his ministry with this effort at what I'm calling fixing religion. We're looking at John 2, verses 13 to 25 this morning. And the story today actually goes along with the story from last week. So last week we saw Jesus go into what was the heart of the social calendar of his day. He went to a community wedding, and he did something surprising. He brought life to that wedding. Today we're going to see him go into the heart of the religious institution of his day. He's going to go to the temple, and again, he's going to do something surprising. He's going to bring judgment. So he affirms the culture, and he criticizes religion. And we're left scratching our heads going, what kind of a Jewish Messiah is this? Why would he do these things? But Jesus is all about shattering our categories, breaking up the way we think, asking us to open up and think a little differently. And for us in particular this morning, it's going to require a little bit of challenge because we're not at a party this morning, sorry to say. We're at church. And so Jesus is coming into the temple. He's coming into religious land, and he's critical. So we can't go, yeah, Jesus, go. Go get those religious people. Tell them what's up. Because we're the religious people this morning. We're at church. So anything Jesus has to say, he has to say to us to some extent. So we need to read these words and ask some difficult questions about what might Jesus be saying to us, to how we interact with our culture. Really, the question is, does our religion need fixing? So we're going to look at John 2, 13 to 25 to figure this out. We're going to start with the first four verses. This is the story of Jesus coming into the temple and shaking things up. Here's verse 13 of John chapter 2. The Passover of the Jews was at hand, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. In the temple, he found those who were selling oxen and sheep and pigeons and the money changers sitting there. And making a whip of cords, he drove them all out of the temple with the sheep and the oxen. And he poured out the coins of the money changers and overturned their tables. And he told those who sold the pigeons, "Take these things away. Do not make my Father's house a house of trade." His disciples remembered that it was written, "Zeal for your house will consume me." So our story begins with a little bit of context. It says it was the Passover. And during the time of the Passover, faithful Jews would make a pilgrimage up to Jerusalem to celebrate that event. That's no small matter. Jesus at this point was up in Cana in Galilee last week, and so that's about 70 miles away, maybe a 3 to 5 day journey that Jesus makes from Galilee to Jerusalem to celebrate the Passover. So the story begins with Jesus being faithful to the religious expectations of his day. He gets to the temple, though, and he shakes things up. Now, in John's gospel, this is the first of three Passovers that are mentioned, and this is where Jesus cleanses the temple. In two of the other gospels, Jesus is seen doing something similar, but it's in the last week of his life, at the final Passover. So sometimes people ask the question, well, did this happen once or twice? Well, it's possible that John is doing something with chronology to make a theological point. John has been known to do that in his gospel. So that's a possibility. But it actually looks a little more likely to me that there might be two separate events because the concern Jesus has seems to be different here. The issues he's raising seem to be different. So what is his issue? Why is he upset with what's going on in the temple? Well, it's not because people are buying sacrifices. In fact, Deuteronomy instructs them to do just this. Deuteronomy 14, 24 to 26 has instructions on how to do the pilgrimage if you live far away. And the instructions are basically, take your sheep, sell it in your hometown, take the money, go to Jerusalem, buy a new sheep, and sacrifice it there. It's pretty reasonable, right? It's a long way to walk your sheep. By the time you get to Jerusalem, it might not be worth sacrificing. So there are these stipulations for how to proceed, and this is what people were doing then. They were setting up tables, offering to buy and sell sacrifices for the temple. Again, the question is, what is Jesus' problem? Why is he upset with this? Well, he complains about his Father's house becoming a house of trade. Now, he's probably making a reference to the end of the book of Zechariah, Zechariah 14. This chapter speaks of the great and terrible day of the Lord, when the nations will come into the temple and will worship God. And so the picture that Zechariah presents, and particularly at the end of his prophecy, he mentions a similar phrase to this, and the image is that of the nations coming to the temple to worship Yahweh. So the temple would be a place then where not only Jews would know God, but where the world would come to know God. So this helps us understand a little bit of what Jesus might be saying, because Jesus said that he found these people in the temple. Now, based on how the temple works, they're probably doing this in the court of the Gentiles. The temple was arranged in concentric circles based on which parts you had access to. At the center was the Holy of Holies. There was the court of men, the court of women, and around the outside was the court of the Gentiles. This was the only part of the temple where non-Jews could come into. And the purpose of this court was to provide an appetizer, a bit of a taste, the aroma, a little bit of the experience of what it was actually like to worship the living God, so that the nations were drawn toward God. When Jesus gets to the temple, though, instead of finding a place where the nations are drawn toward God to experience him, he finds Walmart. Buying, selling, money changing, yelling, chaos. And he's upset. Because the one place on earth that God has chosen to make himself known, and the one part of that place that is meant to be somewhere where the nations are drawn in, has lost its function. Instead of offering a place where the nations can come to know God, it's offered a place where the nations can come and make some money off of God's people. We can think of the court of the Gentiles as kind of a bridge between the presence of God and the world. And there was supposed to be God's presence flowing outward through that place into the world, making God known. But instead, the tide was flowing the wrong way. The things of the world were coming into that court. They were taking over instead of God's presence flowing outward. There's a very funny Bible joke that goes like this. Who is the greatest economist in the Bible? Does anybody know? Pharaoh's daughter, because she went to the bank and drew out a little profit. Right? So Jesus comes to the temple expecting to find a prophet, and he sees people making profits. You get it? It's the PH and the F. I can explain it to you later if you want. So in Jesus' day then, the religion to the world, the view of God to the world had stopped being about God, and it had started being about money, about financial opportunity. Well, then we might ask the question for us, what about today? What about Christianity in America? Certainly we're not like this, right? How are we viewed? Well, I think evangelical Christianity by a lot of people are viewed as a market, a place to sell their wares. We're a fairly affluent group of people that has shown a pretty good willingness to be cajoled into buying all sorts of stuff in the name of representing our faith. We are a political constituency. You'll hear pundits say that if you're going to run for office, you have to know how to speak to the evangelicals because you need their vote. They have political power in this country. To some, we're an embarrassment. We're a prime example of how religion has failed, of how people talk one thing and do another, talk about doing good and yet end up causing more problems than we solve. So we might ask the question, does our world come to us to know God, to get a taste of authentic worship? Or do they come to sell us stuff, earn our votes, and laugh at us? Well, if that's the case, what do we do about it? How do we change things? Jesus comes into the religious system and he criticizes it. Well, what can we do? We can hardly change how evangelical Christianity is perceived across America. That's too big a task. We can't even really change what people think of us. We can't control their perceptions. But we might be able to change how we think of ourselves, how we think of what we're doing, and how we think of the way that we represent ourselves to the world. We are not a target demographic. We are not a market. We are not a powerful political entity. We are not an activist group. We are not victims of our culture. We are not obligated to our culture. We are the people of God. Gathered here this morning, if you profess faith in Christ, you are part of a new creation, a new kingdom that lives in this world but is not of it. Now, this is how the Jews thought of themselves as well. They were the people of God, but they lost focus on what that meant. Have we lost focus at all? We are the people of God. Our first reminder this morning is this is how we need to think of ourselves. We need to be the people of God. Last weekend, I was in Santa Cruz for a retreat with our ministry team of the young adults. And I had to come back Sunday morning to preach here, so I was leaving Santa Cruz early. And for me, preaching involves two things primarily, prayer and caffeine. So I could do the prayer part on my own, but I needed to go to Starbucks for the caffeine. So I stopped at Starbucks, and I ordered my coffee, and it was early in the morning, so the place was empty, and the barista asked me, "Hey, what are you up to today?" I said, "Well, I'm a pastor, so I'm going up to the Bay Area to preach this morning." And he said, "Oh, where's your church?" I said, "Palo Alto." And he said, "Which side is Palo Alto?" Which was an interesting question, and I kind of ashamedly said, "Well, the nicer side, actually." And he said, "Well, do you leave out the part about the camel and the needle?" And if you don't know what he was referring to, he's referring to a statement Jesus made that it is harder for a rich man to enter the kingdom of God than for a camel to go through the eye of a needle. So he asked, he assumed, you must leave that part out if you're preaching in Palo Alto. And I said, well, no, actually, we don't leave any part out. Or at least we try not to. But I was struck by his perception of Christianity, that he simply assumed, surely you can't talk about that part. Because obviously the church doesn't look like that. Obviously it doesn't look like you talk about that. So how do we go about being the people of God? How do we go about changing the way we're perceived? Well, for one, I'd like to challenge you to think about in your life, what is your court of the Gentiles? And I'll give you a hint, it's not our patio. The nations don't come here. We go out. So what is it? What are the places in your life where there's an overlap? What is the bridge, the area where God's presence is meant to be distributed, meant to be emanated from your life to the world? And is it? Is that what happening? Is that what is happening? One of the ways we're going to do this as a church is to take a Sunday off from coming to church. We're doing this later this year in May as a kind of culmination of this series in the Gospel of John. We're going to cancel our Sunday morning services, and we'll have set up, you guys, all of us together, will have set up several opportunities for us to go out and serve our community and schools and community centers and neighborhoods and actually go out to be that bridge, to be the people of God in the world, demonstrating who God is in a different way and hopefully have some impact on the way we are perceived, on the way God is perceived in our community. We are not a market. We're not a political group. We are not an activist group. We are a bridge to the authentic worship of Yahweh. We need to act like one. So Jesus has gone into the temple complex, and he has criticized religion. He's made this prophetic action. And this is what he's doing. He's acting like a prophet. The Old Testament system had priests who ran the temple. They were in charge of the religious institution. And they had prophets who came into things and they set things right. The prophets kept the priests accountable. They weren't part of the system. They were outside it so that they could keep them accountable. So Jesus is acting like a prophet, and the Jews ask what is a very natural question. If you're a prophet, you need to show us you're a prophet. How do prophets do that? They give you signs. So the Jews ask Jesus, show us that you are actually qualified to do what you're doing. This is John 2, 18 to 22. The Jews said to him, what sign do you show us for doing these things? Jesus answered them, destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up. The Jews then said, well, it has taken 46 years to build this temple, and will you raise it up in 3 days? But he was speaking about the temple of his body. When therefore he was raised from the dead, his disciples remembered that he had said this, and they believed the scripture and the word that Jesus had spoken. So the response of the Jews is interesting. Jesus comes in and he criticizes the temple. They don't defend themselves. They don't say, actually, we like the merchants there. They realize that this is inappropriate. What they question is, who are you to tell us that? Who are you to point that out? Show us that you're a prophet. Show us that you're legitimate. And this is one of those classic scenes where Jesus gives an answer that totally confuses everyone. And you actually can't really blame them for being confused. The passage says he was talking about his body, speaking of the temple, but he was standing in a temple, and he might have even been pointing, destroy this temple, and I will raise it up in 3 days. You can't fault the people around him for being confused with what he meant. The Jews asked for a sign, and he says, this is the sign I will give you. But he tells them something they couldn't understand until he had been raised from the dead. So how does that prove that he's a prophet? How does that give him the authority to do what he's done? Well, they're asking for Jesus to show them that he's a prophet. And instead, what he shows them is that he is more than a prophet. He one-ups their request. He says, I'm not just going to give you a sign that I'm qualified to help you tweak your religious efforts. I'm going to show you that this whole thing is going away and something new is coming in its place. That the old system is on its way out and there is something new here, and that something new is me. And it will be demonstrated when I rise from the dead. In the old days, if you wanted to know God, you came to the temple. Now, if you want to know God, you will come to me. And the sign that you must believe, the center of it all, is my resurrection. Jesus has criticized this religious system that didn't offer life to the world. It did the opposite. And now he says, what is going to offer life to the world is me. And the way I'm going to show you that I can do that is by defeating death, by rising again and showing you that following me is the way to life. And so if there's one thing that we must be about, if we are to be the people of God, if there's one thing that forms our center, it is, of course, Jesus. We must be about Jesus. This is why the Apostle Paul says this in 1 Corinthians 15, verse 14. If Christ has not been raised, if there was no resurrection, then our preaching is in vain and your faith is in vain. Apart from the resurrection of Christ from the dead, apart from that historical event, I'm wasting my time up here. I'm wasting your time. We all may as well go home. There's nothing of value in this. It is the resurrection of Christ from the dead in the first century AD that makes all the difference. That is the event. That is the core of who we are. It is the core of what we believe. The world thinks of us as religious. And you can't blame them. Those are the categories that our culture has, and we fit into it. But if we think of ourselves primarily as being religious, as coming to church to satisfy the system of Christianity, or doing what our religion tells us to do, or being faithful to some abstract principles, if that's how we think about what we're doing, then we're off base. We have to realize that we are centered around the resurrection of Christ, around following him, around living out that resurrection in our own lives, following Christ in the context of a community. That's what this is all about. That's what it has to be about. The world's categories don't make sense. It's something totally different. And I surprise myself that, you know, when people ask me, what do you do? And I try to explain what it's like to be a pastor. I'm usually tempted to put what I do in the categories that people will understand. Well, I study the Bible and I counsel people and I organize things and I lead programs and I make speeches and, you know, this is what I do in a way that you'll get it. But what I'm amazed with about Jesus is he's not afraid to say something that makes no sense at all. Because they don't have the right categories to understand it yet. And I'm so infrequently willing to do that, to be completely misunderstood. But what we're doing defies religious categories. We are about one thing. And this is what Jesus is saying. We are about the resurrection of Jesus. So Jesus has started then by coming into this system, criticizing it, saying what's wrong. This religious enterprise they were doing wasn't demonstrating God to the world faithfully. And then he's replaced it with something that is right. He said, this is what your religion ought to be. It ought to be about me. The old is passing away. The new is coming. This is what it's all about. And then he goes back at the very end, and the author of this gospel comes in and makes a comment about Jesus' response to them that clarifies some things and confuses some things. This last passage is a little bit difficult to understand. Jesus has this hesitancy with people. We have to figure out what's going on. So here's John 2, 23 to 25. Sorry, that's Galatians. Here we go. John. Now when he was in Jerusalem at the Passover feast, many believed in his name when they saw the signs that he was doing. But Jesus, on his part, did not entrust himself to them, because he knew all people and needed no one to bear witness about man, for he himself knew what was in man. So the passage starts off with some good news. Apparently, when Jesus was in Jerusalem, he did a bunch of other signs, signs that we're not told about here. People saw those signs, and they believed in his name, it says. Now, that's the same phrase that's used in John 1, verse 12, where John says, to all who believed in his name, he gave the right to become children of God. So it looks like this is authentic faith. They have seen the signs, and they have believed in him. And this is what we've been saying the Gospel of John is all about. John is presenting Jesus as the source of life, giving signs so that we might see those signs and believe in Jesus. That's what these people have done. So we got to ask the question, Jesus, what's your problem? What's wrong here? Why? What is still being criticized here? He has this odd phrase, Jesus on his part did not entrust himself to them. Now the wording there is significant. The word used for believe is the same word here that's translated entrust. It's the same Greek word. So it might be translated something like, the people trusted in Jesus, but he did not trust in them. It's not a great translation in English, but that draws out that parallel. And of course, Jesus has a witness about him. The people need a witness about who Jesus is, but it says here that Jesus doesn't need a witness about who people are because he already knows them. So it seems to be there's this parallel that we might assume, but that's not really parallel. It doesn't actually go both ways. Now, a lot of the commentators and preachers that I've read on this verse think that what's going on is Jesus is criticizing the faith of these people, that their faith is somehow shallow because it's just based on signs and that they're meant to go on to something deeper. And that is entirely possible. This is a very confusing verse, a little hard to figure out exactly what's going on. But as I read the Gospel of John, it seems like John is presenting signs as the means toward faith. So it seems a little odd to criticize these people then for believing based on signs. So it seems like that's what John's point is. So I think what's going on is Jesus is making a general comment about faith and believing in him and how it works. And what he's saying is this. People believe in Jesus. People follow Jesus. We require testimony about him. But he doesn't believe in us. He doesn't follow us. He doesn't require testimony about us. Essentially, what John is saying is that Jesus doesn't need us in the same way that we need him. Now, this could be obvious, being that Jesus is God and all. But I think sometimes we think that God needs us. I think sometimes we're under the impression that, you know, God is really hurt by the fact that a lot of people don't believe in him, that it somehow damages his self-esteem, right? He's kind of crying in the corner, I wish that person would believe in me. Do I believe in myself? You know, who am I? Am I really God? We think that God's like affected by this. And yet, of course, he's not. God is God whether or not we believe in him or not. He is God. And I think what Jesus is pointing out is that the idea that what's going on here is not a normal religion. A religion needs people to exist. If everybody that followed Jesus in the world stopped following Jesus, Christianity would die. But God would be fine because God is God. And whether or not we believe in him, he is still God. And so what I think this is getting at is our need to remember that we are the ones in need here, that we aren't doing God any favors by playing on his team, that we're not helping him out, that he's not going, oh yes, that person, now we're going to win the game because this person believed. God is God. We are the ones in need. And so our final reminder then is to remember that, to live in that, to be in need. Last summer, there was a commencement address at a high school in Massachusetts, and we watched this last weekend on the young adult retreat. This address went viral quickly because it captured this idea that is so prevalent in our culture. The title of the speech was "You're Not Special." Kind of a unique title for a commencement address. But the speaker's goal was to convince these students that they really weren't all that. That they were just like the students that had graduated the year before, just like the students that would graduate the next year, and just like all the students that had ever graduated high school. Listen to some of his words. "Contrary to what your U9 soccer trophy suggests, your glowing seventh grade report card, despite every assurance of a certain corpulent purple dinosaur, that nice Mr. Rogers and your batty Aunt Sylvia, no matter how often your maternal caped crusader has swooped in to save you, you're nothing special." So why was he saying this? He was getting at this idea we have in our culture of uniqueness, of entitlement, of the fact that I offer so much to the world and I contribute so much, and boy, isn't the world a better place now that I'm in it, and I'm going to do these amazing things. And some of that is helpful. Some of that is motivating. It helps us to ask the questions of what role we can play. But the truth is that when we come to God, we don't have anything to offer. We come to him because he offers us life. We are the ones in need. Now, that might sound cruel to say God doesn't need you. Kind of say, well, that's a little shocking. But actually, I think it's a mercy. Actually, I think this is what we want to hear. I'm convinced that we need to not be needed. We need to not be needed. Think about it. Do you really want to believe in a God that if you stop believing him, he's going to go, oh, shoot, this person stopped, forget it, I'm done, it's over. No good, you know, let's just throw in the towel. Is that the kind of God you want to believe in? A God that's dependent on what you think of him to understand who he is? That's no God at all. That's the way a lot of us are in our weaker moments. That's not what we want from God. We need a God that is God, that doesn't require us to be who he is. And maybe this is why the Jews let the temple become what it had become. Maybe they thought they were doing God a favor. I mean, look at all the Gentiles that were crowding in the court of the Gentiles. God, look how popular you are. Look at what a great thing is happening in the temple. And yet Jesus comes and says, I don't need to be popular. I don't need people to come flocking to me to sell their stuff. I want to offer them something. I want them to see what real life looks like. They need me. I don't need them. We need God. The world needs God. And when we remember that, when we remember that peace, it helps us do the rest. It helps us focus on Jesus. It helps us keep him at our center. It helps us to be the people of God, to see ourselves as offering something to the world, not criticizing them or judging them. When we realize we're the ones in need along with everybody else, it helps us fix religion. And that's the question we started off by asking. Does our religion need fixing? Are the ways that we follow God, are the ways that we practice our faith, is there something about them that needs to be changed, that needs to be shaken up? And those are tough questions. Jesus comes into things, he comes into the world, and he just breaks apart all the categories. He brings life to a party and says, what I'm about is not about establishing a new religion. I'm not about this religious effort, I'm about real life, the life that we know. He goes to the religious center and he says, this has it all wrong. This isn't at all what I mean. And what we find out is that Jesus isn't actually fixing religion. He's offering something entirely different. He's offering this relationship with him based on his resurrection, based on who he is, a reconciliation to the God of the universe, that flows out to the world, that invites others in, that takes the first step, that demonstrates God's love in ways that we would never expect. How do we do that? How might we be the people of God? How might we be in need? How might we be about Jesus this morning? Jesus came to invite us to something new, to introduce us to new life, to believe in him, and to find life in doing so. Amen.